Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games as all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.
The opioid epidemic didn't arrive as a single event. It unfolded as a chain reaction. In the 1990s, prescription opioids moved beyond end-of-life care and cancer pain management and into routine medicine, helped along by Purdue, which launched a huge commercial push behind new products like OxyContin in 1996. Federal investigators later described Purdue's aggressive, extensive promotion campaign and raised concerns that Purdue's marketing minimized abuse risks and helped fuel what would become the opioid epidemic. Then the crisis mutated. First, prescription opioids, then a sharp rise in heroin deaths starting around 2010, and then the fentanyl era beginning around 2013, when synthetic opioids dramatically increased overdose risk. In 2023, the U.S. saw an estimated 107,000 drug overdose deaths. About 80,000 of those involved opioids. Those deaths aren't distributed evenly. Some places avoided the worst of the crisis, while others saw far higher mortality, disability, workforce detachment, and pressure on local services. Unsurprisingly, such outcomes have had political effects. When a public health catastrophe reshapes what a community feels like, its safety, its institutions, its prospects, it can also reshape what people trust and what they blame and how they vote. Carolina Arteaga is an assistant professor of economics at the University of Toronto, and her recent paper uncovers that the opioid epidemic caused places around this country to become more Republican. Along with her co-author, Victoria Barone, she finds a causal relationship between the opioid epidemic and Republicans winning more votes in the House, in governor's races, and in presidential elections. In this conversation, we walk through why these shocks nudged communities right in the first place, and why, in the media, the opioid crisis was so often framed less as a public health catastrophe and more as a story about crime and disorder. We dig into Carolina's evidence that conservative-leaning local newspapers covered the epidemic differently, what that suggests about the nationalization of news and democracy's ability to see local pain before it hardens into polarization, and how much of the rightward shift is persuasion versus composition. My name is Jerusalem Demsis. I'm the founder and editor of The Argument, a magazine dedicated to revitalizing liberalism for the 21st century. On this podcast, we bring together everyone from socialists to conservatives in conversation over the most important issues of the day. For an ad-free version of this episode, you can become a subscriber at theargumentmag.com. Carolina, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So the upshot of your study that you'd recently put out is that places with higher rates of cancer deaths in 1996 see an uptick in the share of votes for Republicans in 2022. And like that is such like to me, like just a big leap. And I want to get into like the details of how you're able to really draw those kinds of kind of causal claims. But first, I want to ask you about your priors, because I'm curious if you were surprised when you did this work, whether you thought the opioid epidemic had helped or hurt Republicans. Did you think that it was going to go one way or the other when you first started doing your research?
No, not at all. It was a surprise for me and for my co-author. This was originally the second paper that we were writing on the opioid epidemic. And the first paper, what we were finding was that the opioid epidemic creates substantial economic hardship in those communities that were mostly affected by the opioid epidemic. And then a question that we would often get when we were presenting this work was, well, what do you think are the political consequences of this shock? And we were like, well, we're not political scientists. Actually, we're not even in like political economy field within economics. So it was like, well, I mean, that's an open question. We don't know the answer. But at some point, we were like, well, I think that's the natural follow-up paper. And then when we were just looking at the data was very clear. And we would see that places that before the opioid epidemic exposure. I should start telling you the story of why there's a connection between cancer and the opioid epidemic, and then that, how does that mediate than the story about Republican support. So the story is that when OxyContin, the drug really at the heart of the epidemic, entered the market in 1986, this drug was intended to replace a previous drug called MS-Contin, and that previous drug was the gold standard to treat cancer pain. Now, MS-Contin was going to face generic competition, so this is why they were hurrying and trying to develop a new drug that would take over that market that Purdue Pharma, the producer of both MS-Contin and OxyContin, had prior to this patent expiration. So they developed OxyContin with the idea to take over the market of MS-Contin, and this was a drug that was the gold standard to treat cancer pain. And back then, we're talking about the mid-90s. This is a moment in which opioids are only used to treat terminal pain or cancer pain, and they're completely absent from the treatment of chronic, moderate pain, which nowadays we're more used to seeing opioids prescribed for those conditions. And they knew, so they just wanted to take over that previous market, but they saw this also as an opportunity to expand to the broader pain market, the moderate and chronic pain market, but they knew that they were going to face a stigma from prescribing opioids for these other conditions, because this was not something that was used before and from previous experience from both physicians and patients with addiction. But they saw this opportunity as like, well, we're going to start with this new drug that in focus group, they found out that people thought that the personality of the drug was different, and that MS-Contin, because it was a morphine-based drug, it had the personality of end of life, but OxyContin, it just sounded different. And even though OxyContin's active ingredient is oxycodone, which is actually stronger than morphine, it just didn't have the personality that would be associated with end of life or cancer pain.
Do you mean that it's not associated for doctors or for patients, like prescribers might be more comfortable giving it out?
For both physicians and doctors, even though physicians, when giving you a prescription for pain, they would just change from morphine to oxycodone, they will need to make the conversion and they would know that oxycodone is stronger than morphine. It just didn't have that personality, they would say. And so they were exploiting the fact that this was something that was easier to market for other types of pain, different from morphine, and how we still associate morphine as like this end of life cancer type of drug. And we don't associate oxycodone or OxyContin with that type of pain. So then what they did is that they're going to exploit the fact that there's a set of patients and doctors that are comfortable with the use of opioids, and those are the cancer patients. And from there, they're going to grow to the non-cancer patients who also are seeing those same doctors. And so these physicians are the ones that are going to receive a lot of marketing visits and payments and invitations and just like advertising medical literature, telling them that there is this new drug that is extremely effective to treat pain and also is not addictive. And all of these claims about this drug not being addictive were actually false and were produced from academic research that was not academic at all, and there was really no scientific backing for these claims. But they're going to exploit the fact that these physicians that are used to treat cancer pain are used to dealing with opioids and all the paperwork and all the hassle that goes around this prescribing these drugs to expand to the non-cancer patients that they also see. And so when we look at the marketing data from Purdue Pharma and other pharmaceutical companies that saw that this was a great opportunity to expand their pain medication into the much larger non-cancer, non-terminal pain market, we're going to see that marketing efforts are concentrated in places that have higher shares of cancer patients. And so when we saw that, we were like, well, I mean, if we want to get a variation in exposure to the opioid epidemic that comes from physicians and pharmaceutical companies pushing the drugs rather than a story in which you can imagine that, well, I mean, if my town is a factory town and there's a lot of disease or injuries related to this type of jobs, but also jobs are disappearing. So in general, the conditions in my community are getting worse, and that could lead to addiction and poverty and all of these things down the line. That's the type of variation that we don't want.
I want to pause you here just to like explain the meta concern here, because I think that like people know that economists want to find out or researchers want to find out if something causes something else, right? But not just if those things correlate. So what you're explaining right now is that, like, you don't want to just say, like, well, these are places with high opioid use and therefore they're voting Republican. So we know that the high opioid use causes them to vote Republican. You just see those two things are happening in the same place. And so what you're explaining is that you're using this kind of exogenous fact, this thing that is not really related to either of these two things, like whether or not some place had high cancer rates beforehand, like whether they received a, you know, whether a place had high cancer rates beforehand probably has no relationship to whether or not someone is going to vote Republican in 2022. Particularly, like, high cancer rates in 1996 are not really going to affect whether you're voting Republican in 2022. And so what you're describing here is, like, you're trying to find out a way to really prove that there's a causal story here, right?
Yes. Yes, yeah. Exactly. So the only reason why cancer is going to be predictive of future opioid use, future economic hardship, and future Republican support is because Purdue Pharma and pharmaceutical and other pharmaceutical companies were targeting these high cancer places back in 96 to promote their pain medication for the non-cancer population that also was living in those same places. So the connection is only going through is only going to be through the pharmaceutical industry in this specific moment in time where they're completely changing the landscape of pain management in the United States. So we would do exercise to see, like, well, I mean, maybe there's something about cancer in the past and, like, future demographic political trends. So we could test this in the data and we can see, like, well, I mean, let's go back in history, 1976, and see if cancer in 1976 predicts the variables that we see today as that are affected by cancer. And we don't see that. We don't see that cancer, that Republican support or mortality from overdoses in the 80s or early 90s is affected by previous mortality rates from cancer. So this is only starts to happen in the early 2000s, and it's only the result of the marketing efforts from Purdue Pharma and other pharmaceutical companies.
So let's just so we can get, like, a quick understanding of what your actual findings are. So you're looking at places in the country that had high cancer rates. You're seeing that Purdue is expanding its marketing efforts to reach that population in order to get them to use their new pain medication. And you find what happens over the next, I guess, 30 years.
So the first thing that we start to see is that there is an increase in the use of opioids. So the first thing is that they're successful in their marketing campaign. So wherever they're going to visit doctors, those doctors are going to start prescribing more, and we see the level of opioid use increase. Then we're going to start to see overdose deaths. And first, these are going to be deaths from prescription opioids, but a couple of years after, these are going to be deaths from heroin, and later are going to be deaths from fentanyl. We're also going to see that there is a rise in disability. There is a rise in poverty measured as the share of the population that is on SNAP. So there is a broader economic hardship that is resulting from this greater exposure to the opioid epidemic. And then slowly, this is going to translate into higher vote share for the Republican Party. So we start to see this already early in the 2000s, but these increases in vote share need to accumulate over time in order to eventually change election outcomes. And we're seeing these in House races, in Senate races, and in presidential races. But by the early 2010s, we already start to see that places that have higher exposure to the opioid epidemic are more likely to have an elected House member that is from the Republican Party. So it's the kind of, like, first opioid use, addiction, overdose deaths, disability, poverty, and then, that slowly builds into growing support for the Republican Party.
And if you're not just claiming a very small impact here, right? Like, you're finding that, I have your paper in front of me here, you're finding that in 2022 House elections, one standard deviation increase in your measure of exposure, which is, we're talking about the increase in exposure to the opioid crisis, leads to a 4.5 percentage point increase in the Republican vote share. That translates into actual seats being won in the House. How many seats are being won as a result of this?
So that's a calculation that is hard to run because ultimately these are going to be, like, average across places, and, like, that that vote share is, it could come from going from like 20 to 25, could come from going from 37 to 52, which would change the election outcome. Or it could come from like places that were already very Republican that turn into like even more Republican. So we do see that there is an increase in the probability of winning a House seat, but that vote share is, it's a little bit harder to put into actual numbers of extra seats in the House. But I do have to say that those, most of those increases are coming from places that were not Republican at baseline. So we're seeing that these changes are coming from places that were either like around 50% that it could go one way or the other, or there were mostly Democrat places. So it's not just that it's making Republican places even more Republican, but rather that it's really changing a place from being blue to being red.
And I know this might sound a little bit repetitive, this question, but when I hear this, right, like I think when a lot of people hear this and they're not, you know, they're not economists or not researchers, and they hear, okay, well, opioid increase it turns people more Republican. Well, they're like, well, the people who are the places that are using opioids, there's a bunch of other reasons that I think they're likely to be Republican, right? Like I think that places that are in the Midwest who are exposed to trade shocks, and so they're upset about that. Or these are places filled with the white working class, and I've heard stories about how that's leading people to become Republican for other reasons. Maybe they're more culturally conservative, maybe there's backlash to the Democratic Party's energy policies. How do you determine that what you're measuring is actually about opioids and not about something else?
So we do a couple of exercises. One is we're worried about like, well, maybe this is a story about the Appalachia. And like when people think about the opioid epidemic, the stories that you'll tend to hear is like somewhere about in Kentucky or West Virginia. But then what we do is, well, we remove all of the Appalachia from the analysis and we replicate our results. And we don't see that the results are different. We do the same with the Rustic Belt. We do the same with the South. And this is something that is happening across the country to different degrees, but it's not something that is state or region specific. And then another thing that we were worried about, because there is also very interesting work that showed that exposure to NAFTA, to competition from NAFTA, also led to a greater vote share for the Republican Party. We were worried about, but well, maybe the places that were more exposed to NAFTA or were more exposed to competition from China are also the places that had higher cancer in the mid-90s and that had more exposure to the opioid epidemic. So we do two things. One is like, well, we just assess whether these are kind of like the same places. And it turns out that actually that's not the case. So the correlation between being exposed to one shock versus the other is very, very low. But then another exercise that we do is, well, we can account for being exposed to the NAFTA shock or exposed to Chinese competitions and add that to our regression and see if that changes our result. And it really doesn't do much to our effects because, again, this is not something that is happening in the same places. However, I do believe that why is it that economic hardship and economic hardship from the middle class and economic hardship of white Americans turned into something that is favorable for the Republican Party? I think that the answer for that does lie in the broader debate about the effects that trade has had in that the trade has disproportionately had for this population. And that even though historically the Republican Party had been the party of free trade, they were able to capitalize on this real suffering from this population and then turn the economic hardship of white working class Americans into something that was kind of like their campaign slogan. And then once they kind of like own that topic, the fact that the opioid epidemic also created economic hardship for white working class Americans then was kind of like a freebie on like the things that they could campaign on. Even though we don't see that neither Republicans nor Democrats up until like 2016 are really discussing the opioid epidemic as a major economic and social issue. So it's not that they were talking about decision, they were understanding the pain that this was causing in communities. It was just that the economic hardship that this created for that group of the population was already something that they were capitalizing on.
Mm-hmm. So you're able to find that, like, on this question of regionalism or on this question of, you know, the trade specifically, that you're not, we're not just measuring those things rather than measuring the opioid epidemic. But I'm wondering, you know, I could imagine, for instance, right, like, whether a place has high cancer rates is not, like, totally unrelated from people's politics. Health outcomes seem related to people's politics in a variety of ways. I don't know that I would have called it would make people more Republican, right? I would imagine people who are unhealthier in places would likely be more Democratic, or it's correlating with income, and so you're just seeing income shifts. So how do you, are you controlling for all of those things? Like, how do you think about this as potentially confounding your findings?
So there are two things that are very important correlates of cancer mortality. One is the population over 65, so the share of the elderly in a place. That's going to be a very strong predictor of the size of the cancer population in a place. And you could think of a story where the elderly has just become more Republican over time. And it could be that what we're capturing is exactly that. So we can directly add to our analysis the share of the population over 65 in 1996 and account for that specific, the specific role of that variable in our regression, and that won't change our result. Another story is also that we also see that rural places have also higher rates of cancer. And then also this is a group that has turned towards the Republican Party since the mid-90s. So like the timing also could coincide. So we would do the same exercise. We would account for how rural a place is in 1996, and we interact that with your dummies, and that is going to account for the specific effect of rurality in 1996 and how that has affected voting shares over time. And when we do that we still find very similar results. So like independent of the share of the elderly, independent of how rural a place is, the size of the cancer market in the mid-90s predicts higher support for the Republican Party starting in the early 2000s and all the way until 2022.
So now I want to talk about like the story that you're telling here, because I think that like what's really great about your paper is that, like, you know, this would be a great paper if you sort of had just like left it there. You're like, we find these increases in vote shares. We're going to leave it to other people to try to explain what's going on here. But like you try to actually provide evidence, or at least suggestive evidence, for potential ways to understand what's going on here. And so one way that you do this is you look at actually media stories, and you try to find out like how the media is engaging on the issue of opioids and how that might be translating towards increasing Republican vote share. And I think that's interesting to me, right, is because, you know, if you were to say just like ex ante, before I even thought about your paper and heard about it, like, okay, there's going to be like some really horrible health crisis that's going to make a bunch, potentially young and middle-aged people really sick. It's going to kill a lot of them. It's going to increase their need for transfers from, you know, whether it's disability payments or SNAP payments. These are things that you find in the paper increasing. I'm going to go like, okay, like I think that maybe it would make them less likely to vote. Maybe it would make them more Democratic, but I don't think I would have predicted that it goes fully Republican. And so what you look at is how this story is actually framed, because in my telling, I'm framing opioids as a public health crisis, right? I'm saying like, wow, who do I trust to handle a public health crisis? Like even outside of what we saw in 2020, most of the voting population does usually trust Democrats more on healthcare. But what you find is that the story about opioids wasn't framed as a public health crisis. It was framed as a crisis of crime and disorder, which is particularly in the American context at this period of time, but for most of American history, has really favored the conservative party. So can you tell us what you did there and how you found that out?
So yes, we were interested in how does the media, but also political actors, whether they engage with the opioid epidemic, and if they did, how was that engagement? And the first thing that that I mentioned already is that politicians really didn't engage with the opioid epidemic until very late. We don't see that there are discussions in the House about this until 2016, where there's already 20 years of rising deaths from opioids. This is really not something that is a part of like the national debate until 2016. But when we went in to look into the media, and we found that the media was engaging with the opioid epidemic from the very beginning. So what we did there was that we scraped newspapers, local newspapers, for mentions of opioids, narcotics, heroin, painkillers, and these type of words that would be related to the opioid epidemic. And we also had a data set that will characterize newspapers into either independent, conservative, or liberal, or Democratic, or Republican. And then we were just trying to characterize whether Republican versus Democratic leaning newspapers had a different coverage of the opioid epidemic. And the first thing that we see is that Republican leaning newspapers engage with the opioid epidemic at a much higher rate than Democratic leaning newspapers. So they were just telling the stories that these communities were living at a rate that was much higher than Democratic leaning newspapers. And also that coverage was a function of how affected their community was. Whereas when we look at the stories that were covered by Democratic leaning newspapers, there was no correlation between why this paper is talking about the opioid epidemic and whether that community is being affected or not. So there was the first thing is that they're talking about it more, but they're also mm-hmm. talking about this topic when it's relevant. That's Republican leaning newspapers. And the third
thing, let's just pause there for a second, because that's a very interesting finding in its own part. Like, you're not just making then a claim about like framing, you're also saying Republican leaning newspapers are more likely to cover the opioid epidemic when it affects their communities. Like, it's not just that Democratic leaning places aren't experiencing it, it's that their newspapers aren't covering that issue. Like, do you have thoughts about why that might be?
I mean, this is a period in which there is this phenomenon of like nationalization of news. So mm-hmm. both at the local and then at the national level, the like national stories are the stories that tend to dominate whatever is being covered. Mm-hmm. And even though this is happening both in Democratic and Republican leaning newspapers, at least for this topic, it seemed to be that Democratic leaning newspapers were more affected by the fact that they just wanted to go with whatever was happening at the national level rather than like focusing on their little town story. So I think that that's something that is very interesting, and that in general, people have been talking about this a lot, but not necessarily about whether there is like a partisan difference in how journalism has become like more of like national stories rather than local stories. But that's like one thing. And then the other is, I mean, when you talk about it, you're reporting on your local story. And that's something that we did see when Republican leaning newspapers were covering this story. I think this also in the context of like how local newspapers are in decline and are struggling economically. We're only going to see less and less of this type of coverage. And of course, the opioid epidemic by now is a national story, but I mean, there's still like future economic shocks that we're now writing a second paper where kind of like the premise is that economic shocks that are unevenly distributed across space have been the major economic challenge of the United States in the past 30, 40 years. And we can think of these in like trade shocks or recessions or the opioid epidemic. And so if we think that this is something that could also be happening in the future, the fact that we don't have local newspapers that are ready to tell these stories, I think is a recipe for a lot of like pain and hardship to not be acknowledged that can lead to many of the things that we do see today. So that's a little bit off topic, but I think it's worrisome the fact that story is telling us that uneven economic shocks have had massive economic, political, demographic effects on many, many things. And if we combine that with the lack of local journalism, it's a recipe for like living in worlds where you don't see the reality of someone else and you cannot even imagine the reality of someone else because no one is reporting and telling those stories.
No, I think that that's actually, I mean, it, democracy is supposed to solve kind of a technical challenge, right? Of like, how do the people in charge know what's going on at the local level? This is part of why authoritarian systems sometimes fail, is that like, they don't know what's going on locally to be able to like, fix the problem, cut off discontent. Like, they don't see that the masses of people are upset about one issue or the other. Democracy both forces elites to care about what's going on because they don't want to lose their position, they don't want to lose their power, but also it literally is just like information gathering. And part of that system is the media, right? The media is supposed to be doing this. It's supposed to be mediating like, hey, like this thing is happening here or there. Like, there's a way of finding out that information. And, you know, like, who knows? Like, we're now in a world of, you know, artificial intelligence and chatbots and like social media. And like, maybe there will be other ways to surface this information. But I do think that like, we're also entering a world where averages are used so often and conceal so much variation, like you're talking about. Like, it is a huge problem if 20% of the country is experiencing a massive negative shock, even if everyone on average is doing much better. Like, you still have to deal with that problem, both on the merits, but also because, you know, 20% of people like can cause a lot of problems for the rest of us if their problems aren't managed. But I think what I also want, I'm hoping that you tell me a little bit about more in this frame too, is about the media framing, right? Because I do think that part of what you're saying and what you're showing is, there's nothing that's like natural about seeing the opioid epidemic one way or the other, right? Like, there's many ways that you could view this epidemic. You could view it as a problem of corporate governance. The fact that the Purdue or these other, you know, I mean, of course, we saw these lawsuits against the Sackler family, et cetera, but that these major elite actors were not held accountable or felt that they could act with impunity to harm large segments of the population. And that could be a story about, well, we need to really improve oversight of these pharmaceutical companies, and we need to have stronger punitive measures to make sure that anyone in the future is really deterred from doing this sort of thing again, even if they're going to earn a large profit. That's going to be clawed back from them. You need to tell a story about public health in general. Like, why is it that there are people who are, you know, not being engaged with at the public health level? Why are public health systems catching the fact this opioid epidemic is happening so we can cut it off? Like, maybe some people will be caught up in that, but quickly there will be doctor education to prevent these long-term risks from happening. You could also tell, which is the story that you see as being really dominant, this crime and order one, right? Like, this is a problem of not really health or anything like that, but like, people are making bad choices and they're harming my community. I see drugged out people on the sidewalk. That's hurting my kids. I see needles everywhere. And now, of course, the opioid epidemic goes from, as you already mentioned earlier, it goes from a prescription drug crisis to a heroin crisis, you know, quite quickly. And like, now, you know, all over America, you're still seeing this problem. It is now an illegal drug crisis. It's not just a prescription crisis. And so it's not, I mean, all three of these stories are true in some sense or the other, but what do you see about why the crime and order one became so dominant? Like, how did that happen?
So the first thing is that we're going to do some internet scraping of like local newspapers. And the first exercise was just to count the number of articles that were covering the opioid epidemic. And then the next thing is like, well, among the subset of articles that are talking about it, we're going to analyze the headlines of those newspapers. And then we're going to put those headlines into different buckets of topics. And so one can be just something about public health crisis, as you were mentioning. Another one could be about illegal drug trafficking, because as you said, this is something that is going to turn into an illegal heroin drug crisis pretty early on. And then a lot of those like drug cartels are going to come from places outside of the United States. So there's also a story about immigration. And so now there you're talking about heroin that is coming from Mexico, and then that leads into an immigration story about illegal immigrants and so on. And so what we do find is that whenever Republicans are talking about, are covering the opioid epidemic, we see that they're covering the topics around that coverage are around illegal drug trafficking, around immigration, and around increase in crime rates, which is actually something that is not super clear. So there is some evidence of increase in perception of crime, or how I feel and don't necessarily feel safe in my community, but there is not a lot of work that shows that the opioid epidemic increased crime in those communities. But we also know from other research that sometimes crime rates and perception of crime are not things that go side by side. So so it can still be true that there is a real increased perception of not feeling safe, but that does not necessarily is the result of increasing in crime rates. But we do see that conservative news outlets tend to talk about the opioid epidemic around these topics more than liberal-leaning news outlets, which would emphasize different policies that the government is trying to implement to curb the crisis, or talk about rehab, or I mean, one thing that we hypothesized could be going on and didn't happen was this story about fear and panic, because that's something that happened with the crack epidemic and how it was framed really around an issue about like crime, but also like thinking about your children and youth at risk of like these devastating effects of drugs. Yeah. But it's not something that we found differentially between conservative and liberal leaning outlets. That there was like creating like panic and fear was not something that was there, even though it's something that has been relevant in the past.
Mm-hmm. So one thing that I think is interesting is that there's a difference between places that see high cancer risk or even places with a high level of opioid epidemic and the people themselves who are experiencing addiction to prescription opioids or heroin, right? Because like you don't have, you know, like you're not saying like the people themselves who are getting addicted to heroin are the ones who are now voting for Republicans. And you're looking at the actual place, you're looking at the commuting zones, these like areas, like how they react. And of course, the majority of people in these areas are not addicted to heroin. The majority of all Americans are not addicted to prescription opioids or even even directly related to that crisis in general. And so I looked for more research on this. And there's this interesting paper by Aaron Kaufman and Eitan Hirsch who look at the individual experiences with the opioid crisis. And they find those close to opioid victims are voting at lower rates than those less affected by the crisis, even when comparing demographically similar friends and family. And among those friends and family affected by opioids, Republicans are 25% more likely to defect from their party than statewide average Republicans. And Democrats are no more likely to defect, and independents are moderately more likely to register as Democrats. So like that story is like the individual people who are being affected by the opioid crisis, opioid epidemic, or who have family members or friends who have that problem, maybe they're becoming more Democratic. And that kind of fits the story that maybe we understand more of, like, it's a public health problem. Because if you know your friend who, like, had some sort of, like, chronic pain issue and then got addicted to prescription opioids and then found themselves, like, when they were cut off from those drugs, turning to heroin or other illegal drugs, like, maybe you would, that's not a drug, you don't think of it as a crime problem. You're not like, oh, this person is related to immigration. Like, you're like, my friend needs help. My brother needs help, like whoever it is needs help. And so you can understand that more in like the sort of frame that Democrats might be using because you're more sympathetic to those people. But the people who are kind of further away from it, maybe, right? And who are, again, more numerous, the direct concern for them, and I don't even think this means that they're bad or whatever, like, but it is more directly concerning the order problems. It's not that they don't care, I think, about, like, you know, the people who are harmed by the opioid epidemic, but, you know, they're seeing their communities overrun by something they think is causing real harm to themselves and their ability to live good and safe lives in their communities. And so I think that interplay is really interesting. And I wonder, do you guys find any evidence about individuals in your paper?
So no, but that's a really good point. But we, because our analysis is at the commuting zone and we're always looking at aggregate data, that's not something that we can directly look at. But we were, our interpretation of what we see is really kind of like what you were just saying. And partly is because the effects are large enough that they cannot be just the result of like the people who are using opioids or the people who are directly being affected by the opioid epidemic. But it's more of a story of how I see how my community looked 20 years ago, and I see how it looks today. And in the framing of how each political party has advocated for the problems that I'm seeing and has like just like spoken about the problems that I see is something that would make me more Republican. So it's really things that are changing at the community level rather than like the direct experience of battling with addiction myself or my family or a close friend, even though we do see that the share of people that have close relative or friend that that have battled with opioids is pretty large. So this is still like a big public health issue currently and when the opioid epidemic peaked. But how we interpret our results are more about like how I see my community deteriorate. A lot of it by no blame of our own, but something that was kind of like imported by pharmaceutical companies and how they changed the pain management practices. And that then led to a group of people that were addicted to opioids. And when restrictions about prescription opioids tightened, then there was an increase in the illegal market. And then when we had the technological advance of synthesizing fentanyl and how easy it is to synthesize fentanyl, that just like took things to another level. But a lot of that was not like driven by the desire for that in those communities. These are just like shocks that are happening to you and you just see like the effects of that in your community. So definitely something about the community level effects rather than just the individual effect aggregated at the community level.
So I want to propose a story that I don't even think I believe, but I think I can see why someone might believe it. And it's that if you look at the time period you're mostly talking about, right? Like we're talking about, you know, when the opioid crisis really ramps up, it's mostly under the presidency of Barack Obama. And I'm wondering how much of what we see happening is actually like anti-incumbency. Like people are really upset about this crisis. They don't feel like there's a lot of attention towards it. They don't feel like there's a lot of action happening. And they look around and they're like, okay, well, this is kind of like a democratic like moment. Like it's not just that Obama won, but there was a real sense of kind of inevitability in our politics here in the US around, you know, liberal ascendancy. And like that was kind of the end of Republicans and conservatives, and liberals were really the elite in this moment. And I wonder if the story here is that like when there are these massive shocks, whether it's economic shocks or the public health shocks, that there is going to be like an anti-incumbency shift in the national mood. And so it's less about the specific framing of crime and order or whatever it is that fits a conservative story. And it's more about like, well, who was in charge when all of this happened? And that's what I'm mad about. What do you think about that story?
So we engage a little bit with that story. And we can do a lot more for regional elections, so for House elections, so for example, where we can see, because at the national level, there's only one president, so it's either Republican or Democrat, but we can also see whether the gains that we see in Congress are coming from places that where the incumbent was Democrat. And when we do, when we change our dependent variable to be the share incumbent rather than the share Republican, we don't see that there is really any movement on incumbent, on the incumbent share. So there is no systematic punishment of my local incumbent as a result of the opioid epidemic. And I think that's linked to the fact that the opioid epidemic is something that touches many different levels of government. So from like local police and hospitals to legislations at the state level around how to prescribe opioids to things at the national level regarding the FDA or the DEA. So because the responsibility is at so many different levels, the blame also, I think, is at very different levels. And no one takes ownership of like, oh, it should be the president, or it should be Congress or the governor or the mayor, the one that is really like not doing their job in addressing this crisis. So I think that's why we don't see like an anti-incumbent response when we look at the different levels of elections. And also maybe why the responses were so delayed and so small, because there was just like many, many different levels of government that had to do their job for these to stop or to be addressed in time. And it didn't happen.
Yeah. And I think we also know that, you know, in crises, a lot of the time, that's actually an opportunity for incumbents. Like right after COVID hits, we actually see a massive sort of wave of upswell of support for governors, for the president, but for also in other countries, for the, the heads of state get a lot of opportunity and support from their constituents to take pretty drastic actions, to take pretty draconian actions. Of course, over time, when those actions either fail or are insufficient to meet the moment of the crisis, like people do turn on them. But I think that even on top of the story you're telling, I think there's reason to be skeptical that it's just an incumbency problem. So there's another thing that I think is really interesting in your paper too, because one way that you try to get at, I think, an anticipated criticism, which is, maybe this is not an ideological shift that's going on here. I'm really skeptical that's what's going on, is you look at how support for other conservative ideas changes in the areas you're studying. So you don't just find that opioid epidemic makes you more Republican or more willing to vote for Republicans. You find that it increases support for police. It makes you more likely to watch, or it increases Fox viewership in that area. There's less support for marijuana legalization. Like, do you see this as like kind of like a bundle that people are being kind of persuaded by a more law and order punishment, anti-legalization sort of framework? Or is this how do you think about that finding that you pulled out?
So there's two things that I think are a little bit separate. The first is that we do think that ultimately the main reason why these communities are turning to the Republican Party is because during this period, the Republican Party is speaking about the economic hardship that that these families and communities are living, and this is something that is a little bit absent from the traditional Democratic speech. And so, once they turn Republican, they're just going to slowly embrace everything that goes with that. With that ideology. And so that's why we also see changes in other margins, such as support for police and also having more negative views around immigration. Now, how we think of the support for marijuana legalization is a little bit different. And that is kind of like the third reason why we think that the opioid epidemic was ultimately favorable for the Republican Party. And is that we see evidence that there is general rejection of how each party approached the crisis, and specifically harm reduction policies as implemented were not successful. So we see the case of decriminalization of drugs in Oregon. This is something that happened and then had to be pulled back. Also, there is some evidence showing that access to syringe exchange programs actually increase hepatitis rates. So as implemented, that this doesn't mean that harm reduction policies there is no hope for them. That just means that as they were implemented, maybe we just need better policies, more funding. But as implemented, they were not successful. And so there is evidence that shows that. And one way in which we do see that there was kind of like a rejection to those types of policies is when we look at marijuana referendums. And we do see that places that have more exposure to the opioid epidemic vote against legalizing marijuana in these places. Mm-hmm. So in general, there's just like, this is not the way in which we're going to handle the opioid epidemic. And they favor things more that are in line of like law enforcement. That doesn't mean that we have any evidence showing that increase policing or increase immigration enforcement actually is successful in reducing the entry of illegal drugs or the reduction of overdoses or anything. But we do have some evidence showing that as implemented, harm reduction policies haven't been successful. And then there is a rejection from Republican constituents. And then there is a need or demand for more law and order type of response to address the crisis, which then again can feed into just having more demand or more preference for those type of ideological ideas.
And I want to pull something out that you said very early on, which is around the economic harms faced by the areas that were exposed to the epidemic. Because, you know, I find this a lot is that, you know, people will hear kind of stories like the one that you tell in this paper, and they will really spend a lot of time just thinking about the messaging. And I am now like also guilty of having done that too. But like the actual material situation is like quite important here. The opioid epidemic led people, like led to increases in SNAP use, which is the food aid program in the United States, food stamps in the United States, an increase of disability transfers that people were needing to take advantage of. I mean, that has like long running impact on the economic health of an entire area. Like if you have more people who are unable to work or they're not able to work enough to feed themselves, like that is telling you something about the economic health of a region. And I think this actually leads us really nicely into the new paper that you're working on now that you sent me. Which is still, you know, going through the process of being published. But I think it's very useful for our conversation because I think it gets at this broader problem here, which is that you get to a demographic and, you know, population issue when you have such declining areas. What you find in this new paper is that, you know, people leave places that are seeing opioid epidemics at rates that are really, really concerning. And what we know from, you know, tons of economic research, but also if you're just like a person living in the world, is that when you go to a thriving place, there's usually a lot of people there. There are people who are moving there. I mean, there's a reason why cities and suburbs of major cities are the economic engines of every country in the world. And when people are leaving a town, that's like often quite a negative signal for what's going to be happening there economically. And so I'm hoping you tell us a little bit about that paper and about the economic consequences of the opioid epidemic too.
Yes. So as you said, that this is still preliminary work and we're still trying to understand the whole story there. But the main findings are first that places that had more exposure to the opioid epidemic are going to grow much slower in terms of population growth than places that were not as harmed by the opioid epidemic. And that decline in population growth is coming mostly from higher rates of out-migration. And then most of the people who are migrating out of these places are the college-educated population within those communities. So then these places are becoming smaller, they're becoming less college-educated. And interestingly, we also find that fertility in these places is increasing. So by the end of our study period, that is around 2022, there are some the decline in population the lower population growth that we were predicting is not going to be as large, partly because we start to see the changes in fertility. But when you take a step back, then what you're also seeing is that the reality of these communities in 20 or 30 years is completely different. These communities are communities that, different to the rest of the country, haven't experienced population growth. To the opposite, they have experienced hemorrhaging population decline. But then on top of that, the composition is different. And then the composition of people now is going to be of a world in which less the share of college-educated people is much, much lower. And when we look at how college versus non-college-educated people vote, the type of their fertility rates, their like in health practices and so on, these are communities that are kind of like living very different worlds and realities. So this can also have like very complicated future predictions of like, well, how are these communities going to continue to diverge if over time they're just like looking more and more different? And how is that going to materialize in how they vote and then local politics and so on? So it's interesting that different from other economic shocks, like competition from with China, for example, those papers don't tend to show that that those shocks led to population decline, whereas the opioid epidemic, we're finding that it does. And I think one main reason for, and this is like still preliminary, but one main reason for this is that life beyond like the economic decline, life became too like the local amenities or the local conditions of like how can you enjoy life in your community was deeply affected with the opioid epidemic. So now we're looking at, for example, data on 911 calls, 311 calls, and the numbers of like all the calls that are made to request needle pickups. We're talking about like thousands of calls a year in a city. And we're talking about like around 7% of 911 calls are drug related calls. So this is something that is like visible, that is happening in front of you. And that just, even like we go back to the story about like, even when they don't necessarily increase crime, when you see that there is someone overdosing in the park, when you see that there is needles in the sidewalk, this is something that really affects your ability to raise a family, to enjoy a stroll in your neighborhood, and then ultimately led to the people that can, they move out. And then if the richness of a community is made of like the quality and the quantity of people that are able to stay and find work and thrive in those places. And we see that those places are just like losing the people that can do these things for the communities. So it's not, it's not looking great. I mean, the opioid epidemic peaked in 2022. So at least we stopped seeing rising number of deaths from opioids, but we're only beginning to understand the aftermath of all of these things. And once you see that before, places more or less exposed to the opioid epidemic look very similar in terms of their demographic, their economic conditions, their political outcomes. If you roll into the future 20, 30 years and they're so different, I mean, we can only expect that these differences are going to continue to accumulate. And what are the effects or the consequences of that is, I would be just speculating to say anything, but it looks, scary. And it goes back to our previous point about, at the very least, we should be engaging with those stories and we should try to have an understanding of how is life there and what are they struggling with and what can we do about it?
You know, I mean, obviously, I know you said this is a preliminary paper, but there are a lot of things that we know about the world that really fit this story quite neatly. One is, of course, that like we just know anecdotally and just from research that like people will leave, especially high capital people, human capital people will leave when there is a negative shock happening in their communities. And there's another paper that I found when I was researching for this episode that looks at how local opioid abuse impedes municipalities' access to capital, thus hurting their ability to provide public services and infrastructure. So like it's just like such a triple whammy. Like you get hit with the opioid epidemic, and then you have obviously all these problems that come with that, whether it's providing health services, providing increased, 311 support, 911 support, whatever it is, trying to deal with all of that. And then on top of that, of course, like if your community is getting poorer, you're drawing down on more of your resources to provide those transfers, though hopefully most of that's coming from the federal and state government. But then the local community is really, hampered by this. Like they have a ton of costs that they're supposed to be paying locally. And so it really does make sense that like it's not just the 311 calls, 911 calls, but also just like the amount of money that the community can spend on like parks or like public safety outside of these issues or like education. Maybe the schools are getting worse because they can't pay for good administrators, they can't pay for good educators. Like all of these things are wrapped up in this problem, and I just think it's like it's very difficult to imagine a world in which that wouldn't lead to like people leaving if they have the opportunity to leave. But the other thing I want to ask you specifically about this paper is what it implies also about your research that we spent most of this episode talking about is that perhaps part of what's going on is that there's actually a compositional shift, right? Like if you have all these college educated people leaving, and I think you even find maybe that college educated women are leaving at higher rates than even men, then like is part of what's going on here in the shift to these places becoming more Republican actually just a question of like all the Democrats or Democratic leading people are like leaving the area, not all, but like many of them are leaving. So do you think that's a big part of the story?
So it is, we cannot like really assess what are the political preferences of the people living, but as you were saying, just by like broad demographic characteristics, we do know that the people that are living are people that vote for the Republican Party at much higher rates than not.
Or much lower rates. Right.
Democratic vote for, so college educated people vote more for the Democratic Party than not. But back of the envelope calculation, so like we could just like look at what's the total number of people leaving and what's the size of our of the increase in vote share that we're finding is not, it doesn't account for the bulk of the increase in vote share. So it is something that is contributing to that increase in Republican support, but it's not the whole story. That is just a story about like, well, this is a compositional effect. And that's also something that we look at when we're looking at fertility rates, because we do see that there is an increase in fertility rates in places more affected by the opioid epidemic. And that was like a natural hypothesis of like, well, I mean, if we see that college educated women are leaving, maybe this is just a compositional effect about just the people that state naturally had a higher fertility rate, and it's just a compositional effect. But we also do that exercise, and that's not the case. That contributes, but it's really less than 10% of the increase that we see in increases in fertility rate, and similar goes to the increases in vote share. It's part of the story, but it's not the main driver of those changes.
Well, I'm so, and this is an aside, but the fertility question is so random to me. Why would the opioid epidemic increase fertility?
I mean, we're still trying to figure out all these moving pieces. I mean, one thing that we find is that there is lower employment and there is lower income in these places. So when you see, for women, the opportunity cost of having kids is going down. So in other words, you have also been documented that when you see negative economic shocks to men, that tends to decrease fertility. But when you have negative shocks to women, if you were able to just like separate them completely, those tend to increase fertility. So the fact that there are worst economic opportunities for women out there, that means that the opportunity cost of like staying a couple of months or years out of the labor force is not as high as they could be if you were in a thriving community. On top of that, we're also seeing that housing prices and rents are going down. So on the other side of cost, of like just the cost of raising a family and the cost of owning a house, is going down in these places. So both of these margins can explain why we see increases in fertility. But I mean, yeah, I agree with you that it's surprising, and we're in the process of understanding those changes more.
Carolina, I'm like, you can't release this. Don't let Elon Musk see this. It's a danger to the world for anyone to find this information out. But actually, more seriously, I think on this question of like the home prices versus the opportunity cost to women, I mean, one way I expect that you could see which one is playing more of a role is to see like what income level is most affected by the increase in fertility rates. Like, if you're extremely low income, if you see fertility rising among people earning less than like 50K a year, households earning less than 50K a year, then like, that indicates that it's maybe an opportunity cost question, because I don't think that those people are like maybe the ones buying new houses as a result of this shift. But if you see it amongst people making like 50, households making 50 to 100K or even above 100K who are remaining in this community, then it's like, that seems like more of a rent housing story. So I don't know if you've already done that exercise.
So we cannot really get at that exactly, because birth data you wouldn't have income, but you do have marital status and you do have education. So we do see that fertility increases are higher and earlier for women that don't have any college and for women that are not married. But by the end of our sample, we do see that across all groups, there are increases in fertility. So, I mean, different margins are operating for different groups at different rates, but this is happening kind of like across the board, which was also Carolina, surprising for
we
us.
Can't release this. We have to end this podcast. No, I mean, I obviously I don't think that you're advocating for negative income shocks to all women everywhere, but I do think this is like one of the big questions that people are having right now around how to raise birth rates. And I mean, the opportunity cost question just seems, the opportunity cost answer seems like obvious to me, but at the same time, I'm like, it doesn't really tell you a good story about how you like fix this problem. We could make affordable housing.
we need fathers to step up and do more of the childcare. I think that's the solution to the problem.
Yeah, hard agree. Carolina, this has been great. Always our last and final question. What is an argument you've come across recently that you disagreed with?
Oh my God.
Now you can take your time. Take your time. You can think about it.
I feel like getting to so many debates for like random reasons that I should Good. Have like many examples and now I'm blanking. But
I can so sometimes it helps me to like list topic areas. Like I said, if you've seen like tweets recently around politics or around, you know, healthcare or, you know, foreign policy, or if you've read a book recently or watched a movie that you really thought was terrible and that you were ranting about recently.
For sure, Twitter. I can pick up like, a fight all the time.
So funny.
One thing that I don't know why people are not more outraged about is why do we find normal that children have by default their father's last name and not their mother's last name? This is I don't think this is not even an argument, and
I think this is just a hot fair. Take. Yeah.
Well, so I don't know if that counts, but
do you have your dad's last name? What's yours?
Dad. Sorry?
Is your last name your dad? Do you have your dad's last name or your mom's?
Yeah, of course. Arteaga, yeah.
So, I mean, it's funny because I'm Eritrean, and so in our culture, what you do is your last name is your father's first name, and then your name goes on forever. So like nobody has, like there's no family names or whatever. Okay. And so you keep your name forever. You don't change it when you get married or whatever. And so me and my husband were talking about like what we do when we have our kids. And I was like, I want them to have my first name as their last name. And he's like, all right, whatever. But like, he's like, having Jerusalem as your last name is going to be such a bizarre conversation starter for all of my children. So no, but I agree. It is. It's a break. It's a break for tradition.
Well, in Colombia, we do are more likely to use both last names. So yeah. Arteaga Cabrales, like that's kind of like the default that you always carry both. But then like in the next generation, you only that. So it is lost eventually. But at least there is some acknowledgement that it took two people.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is one of those problems that like does not actually have like a neat resolution, because you just like hyphenation is not like a real long-term solution for this. And like, just as you said, like one name gets dropped or whatever it is, but it does, it's going to make people angry for the rest of our lives. So I'm sure we'll be debating about this until we die. Well, Carolina, thank you so much for coming on the show.
No, thank you so much, Jerusalem. It was great to talk to you. I look forward to hearing more of your episodes.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. On the track, my car's look is everything. But today, I'm talking about more than just paint schemes. I'm talking about my favorite games at Chumba Casino. Check out exclusives like Stampede Fury and my own King Croc Fury. It's just as wild as my car looked in Texas. With over 200 games and new ones weekly, play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.